Welcome to Blue Collar BS, a podcast that busts the popular myth that we can't find good people, highlighting how the different generations of today, the boomers, Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z, are redefining work so that the industrial revolution that started in the U.S. stays in the U.S.
The Blue Collar BS podcast helps blue collar business owners like you build a business that'll thrive from decades to come by turning that blue collar BS into some blue collar business solutions.
In this episode, you're going to learn about belly button to belly button recruiting, 5 years, don't wait till it's too late, textiles are still an export industry here in the U.S., and working with your hands is rewarding.
Our guest today is Harry Scotes, the youngest of a last generation of people bringing color into our world through textiles. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome back, everyone, to this episode of the Blue Collar BS Podcast with my host, Brad Herta. How you doing, my friend?
I am wonderful, Steve. You finally remembered to put the name of the show in the introduction after forgetting to do it a couple episodes ago. So thank you for remembering.
This Friday, I've had some water. Let's go.
Are you sure only water? Are you sure?
You know, I mean, it is Friday. It is drink 30. So let's go.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. So as we discussed previously, you've got some home repairs that you're working on this weekend around the house.
Yeah. A little fascia and soffit repair. Got to fix a bay window that's sagging from the previous owners, you know? So just a little couple little things, nothing.
No big deal. No big deal. Power tools, some swearing, some new words. It'll be great.
I mean, yeah, we do. My daughters have learned that I have a whole new vernacular when I'm working on construction projects. So
here's the key. Are they going to help you or not?
Oh gosh, no. Okay. Now when I'm laying flooring, they have to, but not when I'm doing repairs.
Manly things, is that what you're trying to say?
No, they will run the saws, they will run the drills. They actually like doing that, but not when I'm working on the ladders by myself. And there's a high probability that things are going to go flying, and I will take responsibility for myself and no one else around me. So move out of my way.
Fair enough.
Just better that way.
Fair enough.
And you've got a couple things that you're working on at your house.
Yeah, there's some cabinetry. I'm making some drawers. I got to do some painting and just different things. I have a July 4th deadline. When this airs, you're going to say July 4th. That's 6 months away. No, it was 6 months ago, probably.
Right. So that's awesome. So we have an awesome guest today, Brad. Who do we have?
We have a gentleman that got introduced to, I forget exactly who introduced us, but it was, had a great conversation. So Harry Scotes. I believe I got that correct. Rhymes with goats.
Ooh, right.
First generation American Dutch heritage gentleman who is in the great state of Tennessee with his wife and daughter. He is the youngest of the last generation of the in the textile world of what he does from chemistry. And he's been blessed to go around the country through hundreds of mills and factories to help them with their process on making yarn, microfibers, fabrics, all the things we consume in our clothing, in our furniture, everywhere. He's been involved and has done it. And he is currently he was the president of the American Association of Textile Chemists and Colorists from 2020 to 2021. So that's a mouthful, man. And past president until 2024. So this guy has all the knowledge in the textile industry that nobody knows about and that nobody's learning about. And that's why I wanted to get him on the show. So, Harry, thank you for being here to share your knowledge and wisdom of the textile industry and a blue collar space that people don't think of at all. So we appreciate you being here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So, Harry, what led you down this career path?
Wow.
Let's start.
Yeah.
That is
part of the joy of being in textiles in the United States is that I define it as you can't really explain to your neighbor what you do. Right? You can't, and you're in my world. That is a little different depending on where you live in the United States, but in my life, that is a perfect description of what it's like to live next to a textile professional. But my dad worked, he actually immigrated here to work on a project that was kind of in textiles. It's called non-wovens space. Mm-hmm. And so he helped invent the handy wipe, this little blue and white rag that many of us have used.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So that was...
You're tied to that? You helped... Your family helped invent the handy wipes.
When anyone makes anything, there's a lot of people involved, right? Yes. But he apparently was involved in that. Also, other products like the first insert to Pampers. That was the super absorbent non-woven again, that mm-hmm. went, and that helps a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. But you never know who got it to you, and that's describes basically what I am, right? Is I'm somewhere in the back doing something for someone to make something better, and so that non-wovens industry was a big deal in the 70s and 80s. It started becoming popular. Mm-hmm. Those products are still made in the U.S. and there's plenty of jobs in that space. But like any other kid, they say they're not going to do what their parents do if they're not in the trades, right? If they're in the trades, they say, I want to do what my dad does. But in my case, I was like, I want to do something else. But of course, I end up at NC State where he ended up working. And I ended up there, and there was a College of Textiles, and I transferred in from the Northeast when he moved, and there I was getting a pitch to become a textile chemist, a bachelor's degree in textile chemistry. And it is actually very much a trade, that degree. That school still, the Wilson College of Textiles, it still produces people who are able to work, you know, with their hands in labs, in factories, pretty much on day one. And that's the place where maybe I have this passion for figuring out how to get people to work, you know, to be interested to work in this industry, because I did it and I loved it. I love it. And so, yeah, I just got that degree, Steve, and ended up, because NAFTA had just been signed the year before, I still had 40 interviews on campus with dye houses, right? Do you even know a dye house, right? I had 40 interviews.
Wow.
And on the last one, I took the advice that they all wrote down, which was, he's great if he just cut his hair, right? Back when people still wrote those things on your application, you know.
Yep.
And I had long hair. I was like Braveheart. You know, this was back in those days, mid-90s. It was the thing to have long
hair. Yeah.
So it was also pretty stupid. And so I cut my hair and I got the next job interview. So there you are. I worked my whole life in the industry one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So Steve didn't ask you the question, so I'll ask it.
I did forget.
You did. So Harry, what you kind of alluded to it with NAFTA. You gave us kind of a little historical reference there. So what generation are you part of, or do you feel you belong with?
I am, my understanding is I'm Generation X, mm-hmm. right? So I am that generation that grew up just wanting to be able to work enough to pay our bills, right? Our parents were the parents that just barely survived, right? They made it. They built our lives, and we end up, at least I feel there was a sense of humility in our goals, right? My goal was just to be to not go to jail and pay my bills, right? These were my goals. Take care of my mom. I'll never forget. Even at that age, I thought, well, I'm going to have to take care of my mom when she's done, she's not saving any money, right? So, and I did in the end. I did.
Good for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you go to jail?
No.
Oh, man. So we can't even ask that story.
Okay. No.
I'm too big to get in the back of the police car. I'm 6'5", okay. So that I've seen cops enough to know I don't want to do anything wrong.
So the textile world, right? So you brought up some very interesting things about this non-woven textile world that exists, mm-hmm. and some of the things that are going on. Talk to us a little bit about the woven textile industry, right? So whether it's the cotton t-shirts or the Carhartt shirt that you're wearing, or the fabrics that are going on to our furniture. Talk to us about that and the dyeing and the chemistry and all the things that have to happen,
sure.
for us it's to a get this product. Thing. It's amazing. It's freaking amazing how you go from a plant to wearing this product.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing. And I think what people don't really know is that this whole industry is very long. They call it a value chain, a supply chain. It goes all the way from people growing cotton on one hand, or making polyester resin, plastic, to making yarn, and then making fabric, knit or woven, and then making a cut and sewn garment, and then you know, selling those things. And I can tell you right now that there is a tremendous art and science in every part of those steps. And I can also tell you that every person who works in each one of those steps says, without me, none of this will work. They will all, and I can tell you the story, it's great. I mean, every single part will say, we are the most important part. I mean, in serious conversation, it's almost happy hour. And at happy hour, that conversation is best, because it takes quite a bit of convincing, I think, that the staple yarn guy is going to tell you that the dyer is not as important as what kind of yarn is in this, what kind of fiber is in this yarn, right? Mm-hmm. And so another thing people don't realize is that there are many, many hands that hold the material that is making its way to the store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're none of them, usually they don't own each other. They can't tell each other what to do. They have to work together in tandem. When they do own each other, that's called a vertical factory. So there are some people that try to make a better product, lower price product, by owning the entire process, for instance. It's very rare for brands to do that. Brands are actually just more like buying the product. Some of them make an effort to be involved downstream, as they call it. But basically, you have jobs for people that weaving is done on a loom. And so there are looms spread out across this country, United States, and across the world. 60% of all fabric is woven, probably because more fabric is needed, because most pants are made woven. And then knit goods are more for the tops and the t-shirts and these type of things. It's a slightly higher quality, more difficult thing to make. They cost a little bit more, and they take a little bit more effort to get to your t-shirt level. But basically, knits and wovens make up all of the clothes that we have. And there are 500,000 people in the United States working now to make those things, especially for the U.S. Government buyers. Because of the Berry Amendment, they have to buy American-made product. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we still make about 10% of the world's textiles in the U.S. And you know, we still have quite a bit of export of product too. So people think that that's gone away, but no, we do export. I think it's in the range of $26 billion worth of textiles outside of those countries.
Wow.
And that's because we make a lot of functional fabrics, functional textiles, and laminated products that have a value with highly skilled workers in this country still. And so a lot of people don't realize the level of technology there is in making this now. This is not Norma Rae. I don't know what generation we're watching TV here on, but you know, there are movies we've watched about the textile industry. They're almost always bad, right? Yeah, they're almost always about some terrible manager who's, you know, beating up his employees. And there was a time where that was the case. And so this industry is highly technical. And transferable in many jobs. You know, you could work in this place, whether it be in a distribution center, because we do receive a lot of garments from outside of this country. And so there's an entire industry of just managing these distribution centers. Think about Amazon. They have a crew of folks that are trying to build private label garments. And those garments will go to distribution centers, all need to have people running them. Great jobs, actually. And e-commerce, as we know, has changed our whole industry.
So Harry, as you go through that whole value chain and that vertical integration, you know, back in the industrial age, you know, large factories wanted to be vertically integrated. You know, that's how Steve and I kind of met through some of that, where they had their own, we had our own heat treat, we had our own things, we did our own forgings, we did our own castings, and that all went away because of the expense of being experts at all those steps became very, very difficult. from a budgetary perspective. As you see that diversification happening, what, and you go in all these various companies, what are you seeing in the demographics of the staff members? Are you seeing the, you know, that boomer is just hanging on till the very end because they can't get anybody in to come and work? Or are you seeing younger people being involved in the craftsmanship and in the technical aspects of what's going on?
That's really the part that I'm trying to help, right? I'm not responsible for getting people jobs, but I help them do get jobs. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that we have the industry. I say we. I think I can do that now.
It's us. It's the three of us and our tens of listeners. It's all good, Harry.
Okay. So I think, and there are, by the way, my disclaimer is there's a lot of people who do all this better than me. So it's a very important fact. What I have learned also is that anyone in the textile industry that's been long enough will always start by saying, I'm not sure. They'll always say they don't know. And the older the person is in experience, the more they say that. And of course, that's because there's a million ways to do everything in this mm-hmm. industry.
Right.
And we're using products that are the best option out of many poor solutions. That's the technology. This is just the best choice we have right now, right? And so it's not hard to innovate. But to get back to your point, I would say we have a majority of workers now who are very good and plants are running because of them that are 5 years from retirement. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And by the way, many could retire today based yeah. just on, you know, their ability to do so. And so 5 years or less means people are starting to freak out.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that word because, you know, for many years, people have been just gotten through NAFTA. They dealt with importing and dealing with losing business and surviving for so long that margins were tight. And, you know, they just kept going with the crew that they had. And now, you know, they're established. Anyone who's still running now that was open in the 90s is doing I would call it a good job. And anyone who's adapted to the needs of the military buyers, for instance, the U.S. Army needs things and people have adapted and been able to get them what they want, then they get the margin and revenue they need. And so what's happened is now people are, okay, now I need people, right? They say, all right, now I have to hire someone. And the question is, well, how do you interest someone in a job in a factory in America today when they have their cell phones? And I mean, Lord knows what interests anyone at that age. I am also have no idea. Right. I have a 16-year-old daughter. I can't tell you what interests her. I wouldn't be able to tell you. I could give you a guess. And so she doesn't have one because I'm a real parent.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. My wife gets credit for that if she ever watches this. So,
yes.
Yeah. And that's a big deal, but she doesn't have a phone and all that. So I'm doing the best I can on that level. But yeah. So attention spans are down. When you make stuff with your hands, though, I just believe that there's a group of people still alive today that want to be able to make something with their hands and feel good about it and get a good paycheck and know they're going to have this job next year. And so there are plenty of those. I believe in the industry, it's just getting the right people to those jobs.
Right.
And so I would say, and you know, there is a story I heard recently from a factory in Brooklyn, Ohio. If you know where that is, give you a few pennies. But I think, you know, I was at a Miami show at a group called the American Apparel Producers Network. I hope I said all that right. AAPN. They are the Western Hemisphere textile providers that have managed to connect because of AAPN's efforts. And so they had a fireside chat about how do we get people to work for us just a month ago or two. And the CEO and founder of MMI Textiles, which is a supplier of webbing and narrow fabrics and belting and things that you have, military stuff. There's some camouflage printing, I think, that they do on wovens. And the CEO, Amy Bircher, said they started going to the high school nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the only textile factory in that area, by the way.
Yep.
And so they went to the high schools. They made a way for the summer, a summer internship where those kids would work alongside these employees who are brave enough to say, I'm going to retire in 5 years. I'm excited. You know, I love that, by the way, being in an environment where you're so yep. good at what you do that you boast about when you're going to quit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. White collar workers can't do that. We would wish we could. Right. I used to tell people, you know, I'm getting really good at baking. I'm going to start a bakery every time it was bad. Right. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shut up, Harry. Right. I would hear because I felt secure in my job. I could speak like that.
We're going to get to the bakery. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah, but people who can work in a textile factory and are important, boy, they can say whatever they want. We just say, thank you. Can I have another? So anyways, these kids spent a few years in their summers at the high school. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, they were all excited about maybe because of this in my resume, I'll be able to go to South Dakota and work in a blue collar job up there they've heard about. That's exciting, an opportunity. And of course, the big secret that no one shares is that when you come out of a $200,000 college degree, you're making $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's people who do that, 40, 45, 50.
Yep.
And they are going to make, you know, 80,000 without debt or more maybe. And so the great part to the story, though, jumping to the end, is that summer that they graduated high school, they came back to MMI Textiles and said, I'd like to sign on as a full-time employee. And that was just this huge moment where I'm listening to this conversation going, wow, that's all it really took, was it? It was just to get these kids to realize they felt they were those kids. They felt good about doing a good job with their hands being. And I think that was the experience I had. I thankfully was thrown into a job. My first job was the guy was like, I'll make you the best dyer in the world, but you're going to have to do every single job in this factory first. And so I come out of college thinking, hey, I'm something, right? Which is, of course, the stupidest thing anyone coming out of college thinks. And, you know, you just, no one tells you anything, right? They just let right. you go, oh, whatever, kid.
Right.
And so there I was doing every job, third shift, by the way. Why not, right?
Yep.
And, yeah. Yeah, you got an extra 20 cents an hour.
2 weeks. Yeah, that's right. That's why I found out. That's why everyone was there, 20 cents an hour. And so I did every job for 2 weeks, right? I was the guy putting spacers between the yarn packages on the big mm-hmm. tubes, right? I did the moving around the buggies, right? For 2 weeks. And that was, to me, it built this thing in me that I loved it. I loved doing it well. Mm-hmm. I'm just that kind of person. And now I'm a chemist, a textile chemist who helps people get business at brands, you know, and let the brand understand a particular way. If they use this kind of cotton, then maybe they'll have these benefits. I do that now. But it's always been important that I remember how one of my benefits in my work is that I know what it takes to do these jobs, that these people, when they have to run a trial, I show up and they see I don't show up with a tie on, right? That was always the big issue. I remember people show up with a tie, they're not going to work, Harry, right? That was,
mm-hmm.
So that's, I heard that story about those kids saying that they like to stay, and it's a real victory, right, for that company. And I thought, this just has to be there needs to be this platform between the textile companies who all have to also be differentiated, and they need their own business. They need to be successful compared to the others. So it's not always every day that they all sit together and, mm-hmm. hey, how do we figure this out on a national basis?
Right.
But
so Harry, so you got the company outside Cleveland that went and said, hey, we're going to go to our local high schools. Are you seeing others of those remaining factories here kind of going about that same path? Are you able to take that skill and knowledge that you've learned by watching them into your other clients and say, hey, guys, this is how this works? Because it's such a niche industry and nobody's watching out for it, right?
There's a few. You know, during the shutdown, I remember hearing about the senator said, we need to be able to make masks. We need to be able to make gowns, mm-hmm. surgical gowns. there were some very strong players in that. We had, you know, I love seeing actual government workers do their job, right? Which is to help the people that pay their salary do their job. And I think during the shutdown, we saw that in like South Carolina, North Carolina. There were some, I unfortunately don't remember their names, but they spoke well on behalf of the industry. They made sure a few things could be done. And raw material came to these factories, and everyone, a lot of people made products that we don't make even now. So 2 years later, it's gone. It's gone because I can buy this now for 26 cents from China, right? This mask. So I would say part of the answer to your question, Brad, is I don't know the answer. That's, again, my textile expert answer. The second thing is there are organizations that are trying to do this, right? So obviously NC State College of Textiles, which is the biggest one in the world, they have a leadership stake, I think. And they've done some things working with a college that is a two-year school in Gaston County, North Carolina, just west of Charlotte. They're cooperating together to help people go through a program there at lower cost. They're gonna kill me.
That's okay. They can be one of our guests when you get them to come. When you get them to listen to it, that you can have them come on beyond the show.
There are people like that doing, and then we have our associations like the association AATCC, which is that long association. It's 102 years old. That we have our efforts where we give scholarships to students. We certainly get their attention by that. We do all sorts of. There's a university layer of students being taught merchandising and apparel design and things like that. And so they're kind of there's so many jobs. There's like hundreds of categories in this industry, and we do our best to interact with them.
Okay, right. So let's get to the important part. Let's get to the perfect sourdough.
the perfect what?
The sourdough. The perfect sourdough.
Sourdough. I thought you said salary. I'm like, money. Nope. Great. Nope. Everyone wants to talk about money. Nope.
The perfect sourdough. In our initial conversation, we had that, right? I got this bakery. I want to go to the bakery. I'll have a bakery. I'm a bakery. We talked a little bit about the sourdough. You put it in your bio as well about the perfect sourdough. So let's talk about the legacy of the sourdough, shall we?
Okay. And I'll even connect it to textiles.
Absolutely, you will. I know you will. Because
this is why textiles is an art. It is really an art. While it is a science, we're doing things like telling you what color it is with a number. So we've learned to tell stories because that's crazy to do that. But we do it. That's part of what AATCC does. They have the standard book. We're the ones that tell you how long the color will last in the sun and those type of tests, right? So everyone that works in the field that I do who has stayed in it has some art that they perform on the side. It's really true. And I started noticing that because of social media. I can see everyone what they do. We got woodworkers, people building tables. I'm like looking, I'm like, this is a guy I know from school. He works in the industry and like he was a president of cordage business. And I said, you know how to make a table? And then there's people with orchards of fruit and then I bake, right? So I describe it as the difference between a textile chemist and a chemical engineer. So everyone knows that name. Chemical engineer is what you're told. You make the most money. It's the best job, right? I can tell you I tried that. I wasn't doing well. Let's just put it that way. Because chemical engineers are absolute. There's no art. It is science. It's exactness, right? It's people who build a house. You can't have people who have, well, a little bit. You know, what does it matter? In textiles, we do. It's a little bit. It's okay. And so
it'll be fine.
When you hire a plumber and you're a chemical engineer, you open the door and you say, bathroom's right here. You have a little pen, paper. And you've watched the plumber the whole time, right? He's sitting there doing his thing. And the chemical engineer is basically saying, I can do that. next time I don't have to hire him. I'm gonna do it myself. And we've all seen those after videos, right?
There's shit everywhere.
There's a science to plumbing. And but that the textile chemists open the door and they tell him, this is where the bathroom is. I'm going back to finish making dinner, right? So they're a cook. I'm going to finish making my sourdough. And when I tell you about sourdough, I think someday everyone needs to be able to make food, right? This is a thought on my mind. Everyone sees, you know, not being crazy. You know, I don't think if you have like a store of 90 days of food, then you're going to die on 91, right? So I'm not talking about, but I'm talking about the comfort stuff that we're all forgetting. Everyone's talking about like having the.
We're not on a doomsday. We're not talking doomsday preppers.
Right. Exactly. Because, hey, they're great, right? Just like the guy with the big truck and the big wheels in Houston, we all make fun of it until he saves you from your house. I don't make fun of guys with big trucks and big wheels anymore. I don't because I used to live in Southeast Houston and that was terrible, right? The guy with the truck just driving by, you know, how you doing? Yeah. He's going to McDonald's, you know, and I can't leave my house for 3 days. So the sourdough thing, I thought, well, when things go south, people can have generators, you can have water, you can learn all sorts of things that are helpful to your neighbors, which I think is important. We need to not be so, you know, useless in the suburbs, right? We need to be useful when it comes to being comfortable or eating and all this. And so I thought, well, when things go south, I will be the guy where people come for bread, right? In my neighborhood. And maybe I'll survive because of it. Cause you got to have bread tomorrow too. So I'll just leave my house alone. Okay. All right. So do you like where that's going?
So the sourdough is your survival tactic.
You know why? Because I figured out you can buy the wheat berries. So you can buy shelf stable wheat berries, not ground flour, which we think of when we make bread. But I buy the wheat berries and I grind them myself. I bought a grinder. Mm-hmm. And so wheat berries on the shelf last forever. And, you know, they've taken wheat out of tombs. You know, they're 4,000 years old season. They've made bread out of it, I guess. And it's I don't want to be the person to try that. But I think 6 months, you know, a year, and it's no problem at all. And so I've started making a sourdough starter with freshly ground wheat berries, which, by the way, include enzymes which help you digest it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why our flour on the shelf does not have that. They've taken it out. You know why? And this, by the way, this is every industry has this answer. They've taken out the oil. They've taken out the bran. I forget all the fancy words, but the enzymes, all the things that are not shelf stable, they'll spoil. They've left just the starch or whatever, right?
Yep.
And they took those out because they needed a way to store all this stuff in the silos because we're having less and less farms, right? So we have bigger and bigger silos when there's fewer farmers. Mm-hmm. And what can we do to keep the rats from eating this flour? How do we make flour inedible to a rat? Well, you take everything out of it, right? So everything
here we are, we're eating it. The rats won't eat it, but we'll eat it.
And that's the whole fast food industry. I mean, I'm sure there's a story for every food type, right? That do we make McDonald's story was how do we keep these ice creams from melting? That was the number one complaint. And some guy in the corner who's like me, textile chemist, said, well, we can just lower the T sub G of the ice cream, the glass transition temperature. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? Somebody asked. And he goes, well, you just put a polymer in there, you know, and you know, well, what polymer is available? Well, CMC, you know, carboxyl methyl cellulose. Where does that come from? It comes from trees, right? It's wood. So anyways, that's how they fix that problem. So it doesn't melt on your fingers anymore. But in sourdough, you grind these wheat berries and they don't smell good. Nothing's normal when you do it yourself. Okay. And that, I think that's a tagline for anybody in the trades. Nothing's normal, right? When you have to do it yourself, there's no easy button to press. And that's the same with bread. And so when you make it from scratch, you go through this, it smells like swamp. It doesn't smell good. Like 14 days, you got to feed it, throw it out, put it in the next one with the new stuff, and it keeps beeping. And there's this battle between bad bugs and good bugs. It's like Star Wars right there in your little jar. And eventually the good bugs always win. It is like a movie, right? I'm like, how do you know the good bugs are winning?
It's like a Disney production. The good guy always wins, right?
In textiles, yep. We have standards, right?
Yep.
In making sourdough bread on your shelf, there's no standards. There's just YouTube, right? So, and I watched that YouTube person like for a week. Right? My wife can attest to this. And I wrote every word they said. And 14 days later, the good bugs won. And it doesn't smell like a swamp anymore. And I used that to make bread.
Nice.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic.
And you don't have to get yeast. And so that story goes all the way back to Passover. Right. And the feast of unleavened bread. That's mm-hmm. no, they didn't have time. It says, put your bread bowls on your back and get out of there in Egypt.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. And you can make that too. And that's like, you know, tortillas.
Hmm.
So back to the textile world.
Indeed.
So when we have young adults that might be in parts of the country where there are opportunities, or even some of the factory folks that might be listening here and there from your own network, how do they get a hold of you? How do they find you? How do we get the last of your kind involved in their business and your uniqueness and wisdom? Because it's important, and you are a guy that's willing to share and support and educate. And I can't stress enough that people need to find you.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that earlier today. It's like, what after this call, you know, after this podcast, well, yeah, what if somebody actually is listening, right?
There's tens of people that listen all the time. It's all good.
Tons of people. So, and I'll share this with my network. And so, yes, a lot of people will see it. And I would say if my name is unique, there is no one on this earth who has my name exactly. I've looked it up. So you can search this and find me on LinkedIn, which is a professional networking site. And I think anyone who wants to have a professional life, whether you're in a trade or in an office, should have a LinkedIn account. You'll find me because I'm the only one. There's one guy with a Y, Harry. He's in Holland. He owns a bunch of banks. And I just linked in with him. I said, we should be friends. He goes, yeah, probably. And if you knew Dutch people, by the way, you know that that's a miracle that happened, because they're like totally spicoli. They're like, yeah, whatever. You know, they could meet you in Mongolia, and the two Dutch people would be like, whatever. Right. That's the, I'm an American. So I get excited. Right. They don't get excited. It's very, very wrong. But I get excited when someone writes me asking, hey, how do you help me with a job? So if you write me, that's my name on Instagram as well. And I would say if somebody would find aatcc.org, that is the website for the professional association that I'm on the board of directors. They can say, I'm sending this letter to Harry. I saw him on a podcast. Can you forward me to him? They will forward to me that email. I also have an email, harry.textiles@gmail.com. That was a huge victory, by the way, because, you know, Gmail wants you to have numbers in your name for some reason.
Right.
And I just fought all day. I spent like three hours just, nope, I don't know. I'm not Harry one, because I know there's not Harry two. I know you don't need a number. I know it. And so I'm just giving you your whole audience the hack. It's totally made up. There's nobody else with my name. There's no need for Harry 675. It's just not, doesn't need it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Just keep fighting. When you get that email, make the email yours, not theirs, right?
Right.
I appreciate that, Harry, so much. Thank you for sharing your stories, your wisdom, and also just the fact that you care so much about what you do and the passion that you do. The wisdom has shown through tremendously. So thank you very much for your generosity and your time today.
Yeah, and I hope... I hope that folks find out where you are too from my side and connect. And I think that'll happen when we get the links and all those things. We'll be able to see where all those connections are. And I do appreciate this. This has been fun. I like it. It's
cool.
And you know, for those that watch this at like 8 a.m. on a Wednesday, I'm sorry, because it's Friday right now, 5 o'clock. I'm ready. And so,
yep, it is. It is time to go. So thank you very much, sir. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Blue Collar BS, brought to you by Vision Forward Business Solutions and Professional Business Coaching, Inc. If you'd like to learn more on today's topic, just reach out to Steve Doyle or myself, Brad Herta. Please like, share, rate, and review this show, as feedback is the only way we can get better. Let's keep blue-collar businesses strong for generations to come.